Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Bradley Gerrard, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Good. What have we got this week? Busy week?
Very busy one, and this week that we're starting to work on now is very busy already too.
So that's a lot of results.
A lot of results.
But some interesting news as well.
Absolutely.
So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I guess we'll start off on the 7 days spread as we kind of normally do. An interesting piece, I think, is the chart of the week, actually, which looks at the profitability of UK PLC as a whole. So there's a profit watch report from the Share Centre.
Okay, and bigger stories, we've got something you've written on Rail.
Yep, written something on Rail, which we'll talk about in a minute. And Burberry as well is in the news section after having an interesting set of results yesterday.
Yes, indeed, Burberry. Never a company I've been a big fan of, but
well, as a magazine we are, because Harriet, who covers it, has it on a buy. So
Well, like I say, I often defer these judgments to my staff. Anyway, we're also joined by Mark Robinson. How are you doing, Mark?
Very well, thank you, John.
So yeah, you've been coordinating the cover feature this week, which is our Brexit special.
I've contributed to it, but we've also had Simon Thompson, Chris Dillow, Philip Ryland, and young Megan Boxall as well.
Yeah, you know, lots to say about that. I don't think we'll get through much of it on this podcast.
Well, but, no, and I mean, it isn't a comprehensive review of the subject. That would be impossible within the confines of the magazine. But
I think it'd be impossible within the confines of life as we know it.
Exactly.
But we'll try our best.
We did receive a number of communiques from readers as well, you know, requesting an IC view on this.
Yeah.
And while we've attempted to be as neutral as possible, we have come to...
Politically neutral.
Politically neutral. There are some interesting takes on the economic implications.
That's what we want. Okay, right, Bradley. Let's go back to the news. Let's start with 7 days.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, data from the Share Centre that produces part of their Profit Watch UK report, and it just kind of shows that basically the 350 largest listed companies saw revenues drop 15.1% among those that reported between January and March. And I guess the reason I thought it was interesting is because it maybe points to the fact that maybe the UK market might start to become a bit more like the US one. Like the US one in the past year, maybe 2 years, has been driven quite a lot by share buybacks, that sort of thing, kind of, in a way, kind of massaging, I suppose, the EPS growth. And you have to start to wonder now whether we're going to start seeing the same thing in the UK. So just thought the figure was interesting, and it might be interesting sort of down the line if we start seeing more companies buy back shares and that sort of thing, which we are, you know, I can think of a few instances in the recent weeks where companies have started doing that. So
yeah, I mean, I guess the reason for the headline turnover fall is largely down to the poor performance of commodity markets.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the UK market is obviously heavily skewed by that, and these numbers are, as the Share Centre, you know, acknowledges, heavily skewed by that as well. So outside of the commodities and banking sectors, actually the performance is not too bad, as you've got some good performance from sectors like building materials, construction companies, retailers, not so much the supermarkets within that, but media and sports services as well. So yes, there is a big skew. And actually, an interesting point that Helal Mia made, who's from the Share Centre, was that obviously in the past kind of year, if you've been invested in passive stocks, that maybe has been a very sort of harsh trade potentially because of the bias towards commodities and banking and finance. So their view was, and it maybe is always this, but that at the moment it's very particularly, at the moment, a stock picker's kind of market rather than an index one.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously cover passives, we cover ETFs, we cover tracker funds, you know, and they definitely serve a purpose. You can definitely do stuff with them, but I think the idea that they're a panacea, fire and forget, is not necessarily the case always.
So you're seeing at the moment, perhaps with, well, there's a school of thought which suggests that emerging markets have bottomed out and are beginning to turn at the moment, and that, you know, obviously provides ETFs and structured products provide a way of investing in those for limited risk.
Absolutely, absolutely. Interesting stuff. Okay, Brady, what else we got in 7 days?
An interesting move by Warren Buffett, I suppose. You know, his investments are always watched very keenly. And he's actually invested in Apple, it was revealed.
He doesn't like tech either, does he? I mean, this is a big departure.
No, he's got a major tech holding in IBM, but beyond IBM, that, he's...
old school.
Yeah. It's still a tech company, though.
Yeah.
I think it was pretty much
old school.
Pretty much analog when he invested in.
Maybe. Green screens and stuff. And it's interesting as well, because obviously hedge fund manager Carl Icahn has sold out recently. So it's a development in perhaps, well, some maybe view it, Warren Buffett's entry into the stock as maybe this is a turning point for the company, because obviously Mr. Buffett's very well known for being a value investor. I don't know, for me personally, I think it's a bit early to call Apple X growth. I think if we're sort of sat here, or anyone is sat here in 20 years' time discussing Apple, I think it will probably have grown and developed and entered into some sort of major markets that maybe we can't sort of see properly now.
But well, we have talked about them before. We know, we suspect, no, who knows, but Apple is alleged to be working on things like driverless cars.
And, yeah.
You know, moving outside of its kind of comms devices.
Yeah, and it won't space. Be the only one. I mean, Google and everything is working on those sorts of things as well. And, you know, you've got different types of automobiles from Tesla, that sort of thing. So it's not like it's going to be an easy ride for them if they do go into that sort of thing. But I think they will do. The chances of success, given the size of the company, is probably larger than maybe other players. So, yeah, it's an interesting move by Warren Buffett. I mean, I think people will obviously be watching it. The stock did rise on the back of the news that he had invested.
So. I think the shares look cheap. I really do think the shares look cheap. Listen, I'm no big Apple fan. I lost my iPhone.
That's not Apple's fault.
That's Friday. So damn you, Apple. I lost my iPhone, but I haven't bought a new one. I went over to Microsoft. I went to the Lumia platform. I think it's quite nice, actually. I know, that said, my kids, who I also bought Lumias a while back, are always on my back because they want iPhones.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not going away. No. I think the shares are too cheap.
Yeah, well,
and I think Buffett would agree.
Yeah, well, I think he probably would.
There's obviously the separate issue as well as the sheer scale of shareholders' capital that's parked offshore as well, and doing nothing in the process.
That's the same for a lot of American tech companies with a lot of cash in overseas jurisdictions. But no, interesting. We've been fans of this stock for a while. We it's one of the rare overseas tips that we've given. In fact, it was me that wrote it many years ago. Did quite well. And we've tipped it again. Yeah, it's too cheap. And we would stick by that.
Yep. And I think, as we said, the famed investor would obviously agree with you at the moment.
Thank you, Warren, for that vote of confidence in the IC's stock picking strategies. right. Let's move on. Bradley, what else we got?
I guess just a cursory mention, obviously the Queen's speech was yesterday, in that was mentioned a pensions bill. Details are light, but I think this is something that you'll probably hear us talking about, read us writing about a bit more as sort of meat is added to the bones of this. But initial reaction from some people, or particularly Royal London anyway, they released a bit of a snap kind of press release in response to it. It was a bit, they weren't that sort of bullish, let's say, about it, because their view is that this pensions bill is going to be quite sort of narrowly focused and not perhaps address the much larger scale problem of the fact that generally people in the UK are just not saving as much into the pensions as they need to. I think it's TISA, which is like a pensions organisation, constantly saying that by 2035, I think it is, we'll have a generation that's going to retire worse off than the one before, which hasn't happened for a very long time.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think we'll be seeing more on the pensions bill.
Indeed. In fact, just before we came in here, I was flicking through the FT, and I saw the FT website, that's how I flick through it these days, a story talking about Andy Haldane, who's chief economist at the Bank of England, who was saying that despite being moderately financially illiterate, and that is modesty in its its largest form, he really didn't understand pensions.
Which is remarkable. I mean, and if he is struggling, then how on earth are the average man and woman on the street able to comprehend this? So,
yeah,
it's a subject that let's not get into now, but the pensions bill will probably give us a very sort of specific focus on how the government hopes to improve the situation.
Well, there have been a number of pension reforms in recent years. I mean, my view would be that they were a little bit hastily pushed through, but there you go.
I'm sure Leonora Waters and her team will be looking at it closely as
well.
Of course they will.
Okay, I mean, let's move to some of the bigger stories of the week. Let's talk Burberry.
Yep, so as we mentioned at the start of the podcast, it had kind of some interesting results yesterday, and these kind of include basically moves to try and, I think, as Harriet puts it, which is quite good really, is that they kind of have acknowledged they've got a bit of a problem and they need to really address this.
And what is this problem?
Well, part of the problem is that their chief executive, Christopher Bailey, is also their chief creative officer. And historically in fashion brands, so Harriet tells me, that the creative and the business parts are often kept very separate. That's been going on for a few years now, but there are some rumours flying around that the company might well need to hiring some help to make sure that it's going to actually reach its growth goals.
So where would this help be? In the creative department or the commercial department?
Well, it's a big question, and the company wasn't really answering this. And actually, Mr. Bailey wasn't on the press call. He did the analyst one. So the chief financial officer, Carol Fairweather, wouldn't really confirm or deny anything other than to say they're looking for new recruits with more specific skills across the organisation, in quotation marks.
That's extremely helpful.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, Christopher Bailey is generally credited with being the guy that turned Burberry around from being, you know, a much-derided brand popular with...
On the Essex Marshes,
where I come from, incidentally, to something that's become very much a high fashion statement.
Exactly. And I don't think anyone really take that away from him either.
Absolutely not.
It's just getting to the point now whereby there are things that need to be, you know, for a company to keep growing is a very demanding thing.
Yeah. But the question would be, you know, having, you know, had the creative kudos to turn this thing around, that essentially got him his promotion to chief exec,
yeah,
which is, to my mind, an entirely different discipline.
Yeah, exactly. And it is unusual. So whether we'll see a reversal of this, who knows? I think a reversal probably is unlikely. Mm. I think what we're probably likely to see, if this is going to happen, they'll give them some sort of impressive title, which effectively means they're kind of in charge of probably the creative side, but with, you know, the oversight still held by Mr. Bailey.
Oh God,
that's my guess.
It sounds messy.
Yeah, that's a complete guess. But beyond that, anyway, the actual sort of fundamental things the company is doing, it wants to claw back annual savings of £100 million by 2019 through a cost-cutting exercise. And it's also capped capital expenditure at £150 million.
Cost-cutting? So,
yeah.
See, Burberry and the words cost cutting don't necessarily go hand in hand. It's
cutting its cloth.
Yeah.
There are sort of more fundamental things it is doing, like those two things as well. So it'll be interesting. Obviously, there's the debate about, you know, it's very well, it's got a very good showing sort of globally. And obviously, there are concerns about China and that sort of thing as well. But I think, you know, the Asia sales will probably continue to be fairly strong for Burberry. And I think if they can cut costs and keep the Asian sales pretty stable and growing even in a small fashion, that will probably sort of help propel the business. And that's obviously partly what Harriet sees in it.
Well, I mean, you know, it was a growth story based on growth markets.
Yeah.
You know, those growth markets over the last couple of years in financial terms have had a bit of a torrid time. And as Robbo just said, emerging markets are looking perhaps a bit better than they have done for a while. So
exactly.
So maybe it's one that essentially just rides that trend.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that management...
We just buy a passive tracker.
Yeah. But then Burberry management's confidence obviously is aligned with what you just said, I suppose, because they've also raised the payout ratio of their dividend to 53%. So that's quite a bullish number.
Chunky. Let's talk railways, Bradley.
So effectively, there are these rules, now bear with me, called open access. They've been around for a little while, but they're only used on 1% of passenger journeys in the whole of the UK.
We've talked about these before. These allow competitors onto essentially the railway lines that fall within a franchised area.
Exactly. So, right. So in this instance, there is a live example we're talking about, hence the new spotlight piece. So Virgin Trains East Coast, which is basically, Stagecoach has a 90% stake in, that has the franchise for the East Coast mainline. But a government, Quango, has allowed First Group to run some services on rail within this franchise. So as a customer, as I say, this is potentially good because it means that you've got competing companies on the rail system. So arguably, not definitely, but arguably you could see fares come down. But the problem is, and from speaking to some analysts, is that the open access system is a bit quirky because it kind of relies on some sort of, well, what Gerald Kew at Liberum calls extraordinarily artificial things that are propping it up. So the open access providers pay lower fees because they're obviously not on the whole of the franchise. And you might argue, well, that's fair. They're restricted on where they can run, kind of fair. But also they actually get a percentage of ticket revenues, regardless of how many passengers they carry, based on the capacity that they're running in the franchise. If that makes sense. So I do use an example to try and illustrate that a bit more clearly in the piece. But because all ticket revenue is collected by the franchise operator, an open access operator, if they're running, say, 10% of the capacity in the franchise, they automatically get 10% of the revenue, regardless of how many passengers they carry.
It sounds more complicated than pensions.
Thank God we've moved away from a system where we were sort of subsidising a public railway network.
Do I hear irony in your voice?
A little bit. I mean, there are some instances already where this is working up and down the country, not under this particular scheme, but I was thinking of Hull trains in particular.
Well, that is the 1% of UK rail journeys where open access does work quite well.
Yeah, Hull's a funny place, Robert. I mean, you know, it's where you hail from.
Near enough.
Despite the accent. And it also has its own telecom system.
Yes, it did. Did that morph into... It didn't morph into Colt Telecom, did it?
Kingston
Communications, yeah.
White. Own telecom, white telephone boxes, own trains.
Two rugby league teams.
And a football team. About to get back into the Premiership.
Oh, exactly.
Anyway, let's just... sorry, we digress.
And William Wilberforce.
Yeah, we're trains.
What a place Hull is. So as a passenger, it could be a good thing. Although the potential issue is that if the capacity on lines is miscalculated, what you could see is actually more delays and more cancellations, which obviously passengers won't like. And also, as Martin Brown, an analyst at Shore Capital, said to me, what this might well do, and again, as I said at the start, this is in a few years' time. It's not an imminent worry for an investor in a train company. But when the franchise agreements come round for tender again, which is really looking around to 2020, 2021, will the interest be quite so keen from operators if they're worried that, you know, open access has become far more popular and they're going to potentially see some of their revenues eroded?
Indeed. Trains, I mean, to my mind, not something I would invest in. I once heard an analyst say, you know, logistics is tough, and if you're going to buy anything, buy a firm, buy shares in a firm that moves stuff, and avoid investing in firms that move people. But do we like any of them?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're actually quite keen on National Express, which is a buy tip.
Yeah.
And Stagecoach is actually a seller tip, which has actually gone well.
Gone very well. Yeah. Well for us, but not for
them.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think actually First Group is recently a tip as well, which actually, in the sense of this story, is a good thing because they've just gained access to some track they didn't have before
at
a cheaper cost.
But they're more diversified businesses in respect of how we look at them from an investment perspective. If they were just running trains, you'd run a mile.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, but they obviously run buses in the UK, and they also often run trains and or buses abroad too, various guises of that, just like public ones or sort of actual private contracts. There's a whole mixture of what they do overseas. And I guess what this may well do, again, in the long term, is drive up the proportion of revenues these companies derive from abroad.
Because they'll be actively seeking to diversify?
Well, potentially. If open access is this... Open access is something that was quoted by the Competition and Markets Authority in March as one potential route to improve competition on the railway lines. So if it is a route that does become more commonplace, as an operator in the UK, you're probably going to want to look overseas, whereby you pay for a franchise, you invest a lot of money bidding for it, you invest a lot of money maintaining it, and then you know actually it's going to be yours rather than chipped away at by competitors. So that's what, as I said, long term, a lot of mites in there, we don't know. But the fact that this open access agreement has been allowed is interesting. And also you have a company called Alliance Rail, which is actually part of Arriva Trains UK. And they are an open access operator. Their whole being is about jumping into franchises and providing train services where there obviously has to be a gap in the service. They can't replicate things. But it suggests that...
Well, there's plenty of gaps in my service.
Well, it suggests the direction of travel is more open access. So, yeah, long term, it could be a bit of a headache.
It's analogous to some of the energy markets at the moment as well, because there's some small-scale providers that are entering the market now. But it's very difficult given the fact that both of these are regulated to a certain extent.
These markets are a nightmare. Well, they all exist, to my mind, within the backdrop that a lot of the important infrastructure decisions in this country that needed to have been made in the past decade or so have not really been made. So, you know, we've got problems with transportation, we've got problems with energy, you know, I mean, it's just a mess. We've got problems with housing. A mess. Yeah. What have the government been doing for the last 10 years? What we need is to go it alone, because we've proven that are so brilliant at running our own country that we don't need any help from the Europeans. Robert, let's move on to Brexit.
That's a great segue.
Right. Westminster abrogating responsibility and straight into Brexit.
Yes.
As you know, you received a number of communiques from our readership as well.
Yeah,
I was surprised that so many people actually wanted an IC view on it.
Of course they do, but they want an investment view. They don't want a political view. They don't want to know how we're going to vote. They want to know how's this going to affect their portfolio, how it's going to affect their buy-to-let portfolios, how's it going to affect the economy in general, and the growth rates they can expect the country to achieve, which you know, does ultimately filter down to many companies. How is it going to affect that? So what have we concluded? We've tried to take a more balanced perspective.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and half the difficulty was trying to identify those areas that our readership would be most interested in. And, you know, so we've covered areas, albeit briefly, like housing. We looked at gilt markets and the cost of borrowing, as I mentioned before. Simon Thompson has come to the party, really interesting piece there. He's looking at companies that could do very well in the event of a Brexit vote, looking at the sectors that are likely to perform.
Also the companies that won't get so badly hit.
Yeah, here
as well.
Yeah, he's covering those as well. So, I mean, it's a really interesting piece. And Philip Ryland has looked at the likely implications for the financial services sector.
I mean, let's start with that.
Yeah,
because that's a big thing. I mean, you know, the city is seen as very important for the UK's prosperity.
Yeah.
It's also seen as something that's most under threat from European regulation.
Well, a difficulty exists here for the UK, or potential difficulty, is that, you know, we run a surplus in terms of the service economy, and we run a trade deficit with the EU in terms of manufactured goods. So it would be, presumably, it would be more difficult to work out a free trade agreement in the event of a Brexit vote as a result of this.
Difficult, but not impossible.
Well, not impossible. I mean, you know, if we were to exit anyway, all trade arrangements, whether it be for the manufacturing sector or the service sector, would have to abide by WTO strictures. So there's a framework in place, and plus there's always the two-year period where we'll get to renegotiate exactly what our relationship to the remaining EU members would be in the event of a Brexit.
Indeed, and I actually read an interesting piece about good friends over at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
That, you know, and they were, you know, the guy that wrote for that, I can't remember who it was now, but he was suggesting, you know, all of the kind of negative prognoses of Brexit have been based on the worst case scenario where we literally, you know, we say, right, bye-bye, thank you very much, and we don't want to trade with any of you. But that's just simply not going to happen.
Well, it's not going to happen at all. I mean, you've got the economics, the economics will sort of trump any political considerations in this over time.
I'm sorry to digress, but I mean, you know, this is the thing, trade, right? Trade doesn't happen between governments.
No.
Trade happens between companies.
No, trade doesn't happen because of governments either. Governments tend to get in the way.
Yeah, but you look at this week, you've had the US implement a 500% surcharge on Chinese steel. I know steel is maybe a bad example because of the amount that China's producing, but
and also,
politicians are actually very, very intrinsic to trade.
They are intrinsic to trade, but you know, if company A in the UK wants to buy widgets from company B in, say, Romania,
yeah, governments don't initiate that. They can get in the way, but
exactly, get in the way, and that's possibly what could happen.
I mean, I was talking to Algie Hall about this, and he tends to think that the European Union, in the event of a Brexit vote, would possibly try and make an example of the UK because
to become vindictive and actually put barriers up. But
well, because it could be a domino theory. I mean, obviously, if Greece looks over the UK out of the market, I mean, it's we're one of the largest net contributors to the budget as well. So there's a financial perspective that the whole scale of the operation would have to be reduced. No bad thing, some people would say, but
I'm not a believer in scale. I actually think you get too big, you become unmanageable.
Well, the argument for those that are promoting cessation of our existing ties with the EU is linked to overreach, the fact that the European Union has become, in essence, a political project. Many people thought it was from the beginning. And it's been exacerbated by the fact that a single currency has been enforced in a sense on very differing European economies. It's helped. It's ended up in a period where we've had artificially low interest rates throughout the continent for a decade or more, and as a result, we've had these terrible debt crises, which we've yet to work through and unlikely to work through as well.
I mean, you know, we've got a couple of guys who've given a pro and against case.
Yeah.
We've got John Redwood,
yep.
The MP, who's presenting the case for Brexit. And
Malcolm Bracken.
Malcolm Bracken from Stockbroker, Remo yeah. Bentley, who is a Eurosceptic,
yeah.
is presenting the case against a Brexit.
I mean, I think Malcolm's case is, he makes quite a strong case for continuing with the status quo at the moment. And it is interesting coming from the fact that he obviously...
But I think that's the point. He's saying there could be good reasons for the UK exiting the European Union. We might be able to go it alone, but you know there are lots of uncertainties out there, you know, geopolitically and economically. Now's not the time to be messing around with this stuff. A pro-Brexit case might say, well, if you don't decide now, then you're never going to get the chance to make the decision again.
I mean, I do make the point in the introduction as well, I'm sure most of our readers would probably agree, is that both camps have behaved abysmally during the campaign.
I would agree
so far.
With that.
And it's very difficult for anyone who's trying to come to an informed opinion on this to glean any sort of clear views from either side of the camp, even though you've had, in the Remain camp, you've had organisations like the IMF, the World Bank, HM Treasury.
But the IMF's prognosis was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it was ridiculous. I'm undecided. Listen, I'm not coming at this from...
Well, so was the Treasury's was one of the most ludicrously one-sided documents ever. I mean... Honest to goodness, when you think of the influence that government ministers have had on that, people at HM Treasury will have to do exactly what the politicians tell them to do.
Do they?
Well, they set the reference for the report on the economic implications, and it's almost like modelling weather.
Does the Bank of England have to do what the government tells it to do?
The Bank of England is nominally independent, but...
Does the IMF have to do what the UK government tells it to do?
No, the IMF's funding comes to... United Kingdom.
US surely funds.
Well, no, the European Union. The US funds the World Bank and it's more an adjunct for US foreign policy for the most part. And this is the really frustrating thing. This is the really frustrating thing about this campaign. It is so important. It is so important. And yet it's just distilled down to propaganda for the most part.
Project Fear is what I've often heard said.
Yeah, and I think even with those advocating cutting our ties with the European Union as well, it's border on hysterical at times.
Well, I've heard references to Hitler there's going to be a war.
Yeah,
and...
well, that's right. You know, Boris has hogged the headlines as per ever, really.
Anyway, listen, we don't want to talk about that stuff.
We don't want to talk about this.
It's just nonsense. What we want to do is get to the financial nitty-gritty. How much worse off are we going to be under each scenario, potentially?
Well,
do we even know?
We don't know. We'd be the first to admit it. But, I mean, there are some short-term effects which...
Which are more likely.
We're more likely. And Philip Ryland talks about this, the effects on the city as well. But then again, beyond the short or medium term, you know, he's none the wiser. And why would he be?
So we could have some banks leaving because of the way that the EU rules are set up.
We could do, and as I said before, we might have a bit more difficulty putting together a free trade agreement with the EU because of our surplus in the service sector. However, we'd still be trading under internationally recognised rules. So,
This is this thing. So MiFID 2,
yeah.
EU regulation,
yeah, yeah.
Which UK banks are currently working to comply towards in the same way that EU banks will have to do the same. And now I looked at this statement, really struck me as quite interesting. You know, UK-based financial services firms outside of the EU would have to demonstrate that their supervisory regime was broadly the same as the EU.
Yeah.
Which it will be.
Yeah, of course it will be. I mean, you'd have to get subsidiaries of banks, say, opening up in foreign locations.
But I'm sure they all have subsidiaries anywhere.
Well, this is true, they do. But, I mean, if you didn't, I mean, Chris also makes the point, again, a short-term point about borrowing costs as well, that it could push up prices for gilts in the short term because, obviously, people would be inclined to go into rush into safer assets.
But we've been there many times over the past few years without any help from a referendum.
Yeah, this is true. There's another point worth making as well, is that we've signed thousands of unilateral trade agreements or agreements linked to trade and other areas of public administration, hundreds of countries throughout the world. I mean, that isn't going to. We keep on doing that as a member of the European Union, but we do it if we were separate as well.
Okay, one big area that that certainly the IMF used as a stick to beat us and in submission with was the idea that property prices might fall. This is terrifying to the UK because we are obsessed with property. But Jonas Crossan spent a bit of time looking at this. Both in the retail residential property sense and the commercial property sense. And again, not massively perturbed either way.
No, it doesn't seem so. I mean, he doesn't come down on one side or the other. But I think, you know, that what are the levers driving the UK property market? Has it anything to do with our membership of the European Union? Or are there sort of larger global effects at play?
Well, certainly residential property, you know, there is this idea that London property prices have been pushed much higher through the influx of foreign capital. Some of that capital might have come from Europe. As it turns out, looking at the numbers, the bulk of it doesn't. That's had a knock-on effect throughout the country.
And there's just a failure to build new homes as well.
Building homes, nothing to do with Europe, I don't think.
No.
That's
a structural problem for the UK.
Local planning problem that we have.
Yeah.
As I said, housing policy, we ain't done a great job with that.
Yep.
Commercial property, I mean, that's surely down to the strength of the economy.
Yeah, indeed. And again, it's very difficult to come to an absolute conclusion on this. Because we just don't know the outcomes. We're certainly not beyond the short term.
Yeah. I mean, one of the areas that I found particularly interesting, being a student myself, was the potential threat to research funding. Because we did quite well out of this. This is one of the areas we definitely are not a net contributor to the EU.
Yeah, it's a cracking little piece in here by Megan Boxall, one of our newer writers as well. And she does make quite a strong case for that whole argument about funding. But again, when you look at it, and bearing in mind that the UK is one of the largest net contributors, we do quite well out of funding and science, as we probably should do. But you look at in the overall context, it's a relatively minuscule budget compared to other areas of public policy in the European Union.
So what you're potentially arguing is the money we save from not being, you know, members of the EU, we can essentially pump into our own R&D.
Well, exactly. I mean, you get the same argument coming from farmers as well. And you can understand why farmers are voting to remain in, because they don't want uncertainty. And there's no explicit guarantees from anyone heading the out camp, if you like, that farmers will enjoy the same degree of subsidy as they do now in the European Union.
I think this is the remarkable thing. I mean, you said, though, there's been so much rhetoric in both campaigns. I mean, as Mark's saying, nobody, surely, a strong goal to score would be to say, yes, if we leave the EU, we'll have this much money to spend on this. I've not heard anybody say that.
No, and
surely that would be a factual thing. There's a factual number, surely, we spend on the EU.
9 billion.
Well, where would that factual number go? Why won't somebody tell us?
I think they have been telling us, but I think so many other people have been trying to you know, basically say, well, it's not quite that, or you could look at it this way.
Jeremy Hunt saying, oh, well, I'm going to spend it on the NHS, doctors, don't worry, don't strike or anything. I mean, there's been nothing like that at all. And I think, I don't know,
as we say, the campaign's been a mess.
It's just descended into farce. I'm sure most people feel much the same way. In fact, most people I talk to thoroughly frustrated with the whole process.
Because they want to vote, but based upon facts.
Yeah.
Or as close to facts as you can get in something like this, which is actually looking into the future.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is crystal ball stuff for the most part, but that doesn't mean to say that you can't have a genuine cognitive response to it. And it seems to be totally driven by emotion in many cases.
Mm. And as I say, I'm editorial. Worst thing you can do in investing, worst thing you possibly do in the case of a Brexit referendum as well.
Yeah, well, this is it.
I think I'll be, I think I'm...
We shouldn't, let's remain agnostic.
I'm going to remain agnostic. I'll be agnostic until the final minute. I will probably still have not made my mind up when I walk into that polling booth and then spoil the ballot paper.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, yeah.
Join NAFTA.
I think it's a really interesting piece, Robert. I think well done for putting it together. You pulled some great stuff together from the team. It's a long piece.
Yeah, but it is.
A surprisingly easy read because it is so interesting and so important.
Well, it is. There's some really good stuff in there as well. I mean, the writers have done so well. And as I say, with Simon at the end, you know, well, if you're confused by the whole thing, why not try and exploit it?
Yes, Yes, you can do that. And Simon presents some ways that you can actually just play the vote. If you, you know, if you have a trading bent, then you can you can trade. Yeah, there's potential ways to profit from Brexit or Remain.
Yeah, well, you know, Simon's laying on the beach in Skiathos at the moment, I think. So he's probably profiting at this as we speak.
Indeed, and you know, we spoke earlier, Robbo, about services. That subject your sex focus this week as well. The invisible exports we do so well in this country. I mean, we don't need to talk about it now. There's a video, I assume, on the.
There is. I spoke to Harriet Russell this morning as well, but it's interesting. It sort of it dovetails with the whole Brexit issue as well. And it's a large subject, and I've only mentioned a few little companies in there as well, but it's worth having a look at.
So hang on, Robert, speaking of Harriet, producers just speaking to me in the headphones, Harriet Russell has won the Wincott Award for Young Journalist of the Year.
Well, fantastic.
That is amazing.
Well, it did, and it's a just reward as well. She produced some fantastic stuff over the last year and beyond, of course. So well done to Harriet.
Yeah, well done.
Amazing.
Very well deserved. And destined for great things. Let's talk about some results before we sign off. We're going to keep this brief, so I'm going to say, Bradley, you've written a lot this week.
I've written a few.
What's your highlight?
Well, I guess a bit of a theme. There have been quite a few pub groups reporting recently. Okay. There's been another one today, actually, Young's reported today, which I'm just going to focus on when I return to my desk. But we had Enterprise Inns, which is obviously a very big company. It's going to potentially be a bit hit by new government laws which will allow tied publicans to cut the beer tie and sort of pay the parent only, like rent only. But it's managing that well. It's changing its agreement with publicans to kind of entice them to stay. So that's kind of interesting. We're on hold there at the moment because it is a bit of a turnaround story.
Well, it's amazing that it's still going after the tribulations that it's been through.
Well, potentially so, yeah. And Marston's as well was the other pub group which reported. We're a bit more bullish on this one. We've got it on a buy. Food sales, particularly driving that there, they've really sort of focused on what they're offering food-wise there, sort of special, you know, sort of open kitchens to sort of entice people in and, kind of heading for that premium kind of market. And actually, Marston's is a very big brewer as well, and they bought Thwaites recently, and that's really helped their brewing division too.
Okay, Bradley, thank you. And Robert, you've been so busy with the feature, you haven't actually covered an enormous amount of results this week. I'll be having a word with you about that later. What else we got in results? I mean, it's been quite a busy week, isn't it, Bradley? A lot of property, British Land Securities, both looking quite good. TalkTalk, been having a horror lately.
Yeah, the old breach of security.
Yeah, never a good thing. Vodafone, actually doing a bit better than it has for a while. Some more in your sector, actually. Premier Foods, Greencore. So, yeah, I mean, an interesting week. Oh, Patisserie, we've talked about that quite a lot recently, haven't we? Results picking up. We're going to get busy again next week as well, I assume.
Absolutely.
I can't wait. And, okay, probably ran out of time. Reached the end of our slot. So, yeah, having put Europe to rights and the National Railways to rights, it's probably time to wrap up. All the usual stuff in the magazine. We have a useful stock screen from Algie Hall. Cyclical recovery plays, which he calls his late bloomers. These are the companies that perform better later on in the cycle. It's been good. It didn't have a great year last year, although it still beat the market. And still over the last few years has significantly outperformed, as Algie stock screens often do. Lots more in the comments section, lots more in the news section that we haven't covered, lots of company-specific news there. We've got the next part of our 50 objects of investing, talking about hostile takeovers, and the objects in question are a bottle of Johnny Walker Red Label and a packet of Embassy.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Exactly.
And even more on the Brexit theme in the personal finance and fund section, which they will no doubt talk about on their podcast when they record it tomorrow. So thank you very much. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Robbo. And once again, well done to Harriet Russell.
Yay.
Very well-deserved award there. Pick up the magazine. You can't miss it. Brexit cutting through the noise. £4.70 in all good newsagents. And we will catch up again next week. Goodbye.